Welcome to Writers on Writing's first straight to podcast episode. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My shows usually air first on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus, but today we're doing something different. We're doing a straight to podcast episode because the writers joining me and I have an anthology out called Crossing Borders, published by Down and Out Books. And KUCI has a silly rule that public affairs hosts cannot promo their own work. It might be a silly rule, but it can be annoying when radio show hosts start promoting themselves. So I'm okay with that. But I love the book. And because of COVID-19, we were not able to have our scheduled book launch at Left Coast Crime Conference in March in San Diego. The show doesn't make up for the launch, but it's a little something, I hope, that will let readers know about a fantastic collection, if I do say so myself. I have with me Kathy Cravat and Lisa Brackman. Kathy Cravat is the author of the Gourmet Cat Mystery Series featuring cat food chef Colby Summers and her demanding cat Trouble. She also writes the best-selling chocolate-covered mystery series under the name Kathy Ahrens. Her short story, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was selected for the Crossing Borders anthology published by Down and Out in March. And Lisa Brackman is the New York Times bestselling author of the L.A. McEnroe novels set in China and the thrillers Getaway and Go Between. She's an editor along with Matt Coyle of Crossing Borders. So welcome you guys, you ladies, you women, for being here with me to do this. I don't know why I didn't think of doing this a long time ago, but we're doing it now. So thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you.
Maybe let's begin with the two of you talking about how the anthology came about.
I think Kathy actually is probably better equipped to speak to that than I am. It was something that, we have a relatively new chapter of Sisters in Crime in San Diego. And since Left Coast Crime was going to be held in San Diego, the idea came up that we should do our first anthology to coincide with Left Coast Crime. And that's about as much as I know until I was asked to be one of the editors. So maybe Kathy can tell us more.
Yeah.
Yes. The board, spoke about it for months because it is quite an undertaking, and then decided to take it on. There was a few volunteers with Partners in Crime that were also helping with Left Coast Crime, so it seemed like a very good synergy. And then the idea of crossing borders because of where we are, in San Diego, close to the border, came about. But we expanded the idea to include any kind of border, not just physical ones, but, crossing over to a paranormal or some other border.
So then the idea came about to do it. And then how did you decide which Sisters in Crime chapters or members could contribute a story? And how did that happen? Because I think it was west of the Mississippi. Was that it? Or west of the Rockies, something like that?
No. Well, because San Diego Sisters in Crime is a relatively new chapter, and the membership was, we weren't sure that the membership would have enough writers to support an entire anthology, so we opened it up to participation to Sisters in Crime Orange County, and Kathy, wasn't LA was also included, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't remember if there were any Inland Empire chapters, but it was basically just a way to, expand our applicant pool a bit beyond what we had here in town.
Okay, with Southern California, with the few Southern California chapters that are here. All right. And then Down and Out Books, how did they get involved?
Well, they've done this kind of work. Kathy, did you work with them, or was that Kim Keyline?
At the beginning, it was me, and then it switched over to Kim. She handled the bulk of the publishing work after the stories were selected. And they had done a really good job with Sisters in Crime LA chapter anthology and some other Sisters in Crime. So that was one of the reasons the board chose them.
Hmm. So, okay, so then you put out the call for stories start coming in. And did you have sort of criteria that you needed to stick to, or you know, how did you pick the stories that you included?
Well, so Matt and I, the stories came to us anonymously. We didn't know who wrote them. We kept a pretty open mind about what crossing borders could mean potentially, because you know, most of the stories didn't really engage with the literal border. So it was really just which stories we thought were of the best quality. At the end of the day, you pick the best writing that you can find, and that was what we did.
How many came in? Do you remember?
Oh, 39. God. It was a lot.
39.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. And they both read all of the stories, which was awesome.
So. It was a lot, yeah.
That is
more
a lot.
Than I thought.
So would you like go back and forth? Like, did you have stories, Lisa, that you wanted and Matt said no? Or did he have stories and you said no? Or did the two of you pretty much pick the same ones?
We were pretty much in agreement. There were a couple when we got to the like, not sure at the end where we differed. And there was one that we had a big disagreement about. I remember, but the, you know, if I felt really strongly about something and he felt really strongly about something, we weren't going to, say, no, you can't have that one, you know, because, and part of the task force, and it was involved with the selection as well as the actual editorial process, is that you can't really just apply your own standards of taste to the work that you're getting, mm-hmm. because, you know, different writers write different things, different readers want different things. So you try to look at everything in terms of what the author was trying to accomplish with the story, and you work from there. So, you know, at the end of the day, quality is quality. Whether it's a subgenre or a topic that you as an editor or as a reader are particularly interested in. But I like to think that, you know, even if this isn't my kind of thing, I can still go, you know what, for this kind of thing, this is well done. So we're taking it.
So, and then editing, I mean, how did that go? Because I don't know. I mean, I think it's always.
Well, you
fun
guys
work.
Both worked with me. You can.
I know.
You can tell me how it went.
Well,
you know.
I mean, you were fun to work with, and I always think on an, you know, from an editor's point of view, do you have to deal with people that are going, no, you can't change that, or you know, no, you know, so that you have to kind of then deal with how important is this battle and. Or did you not have to go through that? Was everyone pretty much in agreement with, you know, what you and Matt wanted
pretty,
to see happen?
I can't speak to Matt's experiences, but, you know, there are always, especially with people that aren't experienced with the process, that usually tends to be more of a deal than people that are, because they just don't really know what to expect. They don't know how it goes, you know. But... just like I said, if you start from a place of going, this is what the author's intentions are, my job as an editor is to help the author realize their vision. It's not to impose my vision on it or to write the story that I would have written. It's to help them make their story better. And for the most part, people were really, you know, responded really well to that. And you know, obviously, I've been on the other side of this enough times with novels. And as a writer, my process was always, accept the easy changes first. You know, it's like, okay, fine. Yeah, I don't have a problem with this. Okay, this is great. Okay. You know, the stuff that was a little harder to do, but that I felt needed to be done, I put a little later in the process. And then at the end, if there were things that were just like, no, absolutely, this needs to be here the way that I wrote it, you know, but you save those for the stuff that's really important. And I don't actually think I ran into any of that with the short stories. I think most of it was just, you know, questions of language and clarity and, you know, you're trying to make this point. How can we make this point better? Or, you know, I'm not clear on what the action is here. How can we, you know, how can we clarify this? So, you know, aside from just the bulk of the stories and the time frame that all of this needed to be done on, it was not a bad editorial process at all from my perspective.
Hmm. Kathy, your story, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, is quite prescient. I mean, oh my gosh, I started reading this and I'm going, did she know?
And that's, yeah, that was very odd. I actually wrote this several years ago, I'm going to say 3 or 4 years ago, as a, thinking it might be a novel, but it didn't really work that way. So I rewrote it for this anthology as a short story. Also, the third book in my The Gourmet Cat Mystery series that came out in 2019, it was about a college admission scandal. So that was written a year
before.
That's
strange.
Yeah. I've decided my next book is going to be about someone finding a vaccine for COVID. So that make it all happen.
Yeah. So the premise of Kathy's story, and it was, you know, we loved it so much, was the sentient god of flu that's there to bring death and solve a murder at the same time. So it was it was really, really a great story, and Matt and I kind of fought over who got to edit it. So.
Yeah, really.
I won.
Kathy, do you want to read a little bit from it?
I can read the opening, perhaps. Yeah. So it's called One Flew Over This Cuckoo's Nest, and flu is spelled like the disease. So it starts off with, she was already dead. To most, that fact wouldn't be remarkable. Angela Willis was an elderly, before her time, woman in the advanced stages of lung cancer, activated by a secret smoking habit that even her deceased husband had never known about. But I knew that her death had happened too early, because I was supposed to kill her. My day began like any other. I traveled from hand to hand, blown through the air by a cough, then a sneeze, and a convoluted route of public buses, 18-wheeled behemoths, and inside a particularly fruitful family minivan with stickers on the back window, each with a child's name, the window just begging for an attack by a serial killer. It would have to settle for me. If I could feel pity, I'd have reserved some for the mother of the soon-to-be coughing, sneezing, and whining family. Some would imagine that I was a simple virus, but they'd be dangerously wrong. I am the superhero of illness, a demigod of influenza, a first cousin to death. Not that he showed up at family reunions or anything. So, I think that's it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, it's not funny, because Left Coast Crime, the people listening may not know that Left Coast Crime was to take place, I think March 12th to 14th, was it? Or March 11th to 15th?
11th to 15th, yeah.
Right in there. And so, you know, we arrive on the 12th and, you know, go to a panel or two, go out to dinner, come back. The conference has been closed down. And so this book was to launch that night. And so your story, you know, just... it's so strange. Interesting.
Very odd coin.
What inspired it?
I get a lot of ideas when I'm walking. So I think it's hard to remember exactly, but I think I was walking and thought, it's kind of popped into my head, what would a flu virus, you know, do if we wanted to solve a mystery? And then just became a whole bunch of what ifs. What skills would it have? What kind of mystery would even interest it? So, so it had to, you know, the way it started was the only way I could think of that would interest a demigod of flu. So, that's what inspired it.
Well, I feel like I should ask, Since Barbara also had one of my favorite stories in the collection, which I also got to edit, would it be okay for me to ask you about the genesis of your story? It was so atmospheric. I mean, I still think about the pool light. For some reason, that's the image that sticks with me. You know, the weird reflective light off the pool, and it's very evocative, and it talks about a side of Orange County I think that a lot of people don't know about. So can I ask you to talk about your story?
Yeah, of course you can. Well, you know, I wish I knew where it came from. I had written a story for Orange County Noir that Akashic published back in, I think, 2010. And it took place at this converted motel, the Placenta Arms, which is missing the I in the sign. So it's Placenta, not Placentia. And so in that story, in the Crazy for You that was in Akashic, the main character there just, you know, she never wants to have a baby. She hates the idea of blood. And she just, it's just not a good sign that she's living somewhere with a sign that says Placenta. And so after that story, I just love a setting. And I thought, well, what else might happen here? You know, what else might happen here? And, you know, who knows how stories come about? I mean, I wish I did know, because, you know, I kind of like it. I like the structure of it. But I don't know, one thing led to another, and she finds a bottle in the pool with a note that's in the bottom of the bottle that says, help me. And she has to figure out who wrote it. And so, but it was really the setting. I think the setting more than anything kind of got it going, because, and I have a few more stories that take place at that converted motel.
You know, do you want to read from it?
Yeah, sure. I'll read from it. I'll read the beginning. So it's called Pool Fishing. The sun lumbered over the auto body shop across the street, and a scrim of pink outlined its corrugated roof. The pool below my apartment turned my favorite color, sea glass, masking the murk that was all too apparent at high noon. In my galley kitchen, I tipped Mr. Coffee over my cup and went out onto the landing. From my vantage point on the second floor of the Placenta Arms, the eye fizzled out long ago. Apartment doors opened and dispelled men, mostly gardeners and construction workers. The still fresh air smelled of salt from the ocean a mile away. When the Costa Mesa fabricas, auto body shops, and taquerias got busy, exhaust and fried food smells, not altogether unpleasant, replaced the salty fragrance. The swimming pool drew my attention. On the surface of the water, a Bud beer bottle bobbed about, not so unusual at the Arms, but the bottle looked stopped up with a plastic bag. Odd. I retied the belt of my bathrobe and hurried down the prefab stone steps. The bottle was too far out of reach, but the leaf sifter's pole was long. I used it to draw the bottle in. I hoped no one was watching. Silly, a grown woman circling 40, fishing bottles from a swimming pool. I returned the sifter to its place and tucked the trophy inside my robe, cold against my bare skin. The gravel-embedded laminate felt slick on the bottom of my feet as I rushed back upstairs. So that's the beginning. And yeah, you know, it's a side of Orange County that, yeah, I don't read about either. And, you know, there's a lot of these sides of Orange County, you know, in towns that, in cities that have beautiful neighborhoods as well. And there's the wrong side of town where, you know, the low-income people live and work, and well, they don't work. A lot of them are laborers, so they leave that side of town to go to the more beautiful Orange County neighborhoods. Mm. So it just really interests me that, you know, there's this, I guess there's class divide everywhere, I suppose, you know, and people think of Orange County as Real Housewives, right? And all the movies or shows that take place here, that really is not the bulk of what's happening here. So anyway, do you both deal with setting? How do you both deal with setting? I mean, is that important to you? Do settings inspire you with whatever you're writing?
Yeah. I mean, I you know, it's like, it used to be, if there was a panel that was about mysteries and exotic foreign places, you know, I was going to get put on that panel. The Ellie McEnroe books are set in contemporary China, although at this point, you know, last one was set in 2012, and it's already changed so much since then. So it's almost a period piece. And I did one set in Puerto Vallarta, and then I turned to the U.S. So my last two books have been set in the U.S. Go Between, which is set in California and in Houston, and then Black Swan Rising, which is my latest book and is set in San Diego, in exotic Claremont, where I currently reside. And, you know, I find the key to this, you know, when I was writing about China, was you don't want to exoticize a setting, you know, because basically to the, you know, what is it, 1 billion Chinese, or, you know, they wake up every morning and it's not exotic to them. It's where they mm-hmm. live and work and play and eventually pass on. And then the other side of that, you know, is that when I travel, which I hope to do again someday soon after this, when I would tell people where I was from, I went to Russia a couple of times, and you say that you're from California and that you worked in Hollywood, and it's like, wow, you know, to a lot of people, that's one of the most exotic settings in the world. Southern California, you all surf, you know, Hollywood, movie stars, all of that. And I'm going like, you know, I mean, I was born and raised in San Diego. There's nothing particularly exotic. It is normal to me. And it really wasn't until I started traveling, even more so in other parts of the United States, where I realized that what I thought was baseline normal way to grow up and live was in fact very exotic to other people that weren't familiar with it. So yeah, to some, this little roundabout way, setting is really important to me. And the rules of setting for me is to look for the ordinary in the exotic and the exotic in the ordinary. So, you know, when I do my neighborhood walks, I'm constantly on the lookout for strange little details about the burbs where I live. If you go onto my Instagram account, I have a hashtag that's the Wilds of Claremont, and you know, which shows some of the little oddities that are here everywhere if you take the time to look for them.
What about you, Kathy?
So my first six books were cozy mysteries. So setting is pretty important in terms of creating a community that, you know, it's kind of the small world that a cozy mystery happens in. I should explain that cozy is like a publishing term for a book with an amateur sleuth. So not a, you know, private investigator or a police officer. In a normally a small town, or at least a community that could be like a small part of Brooklyn, New York, something like that. So, and it doesn't have a lot of, has no sex on the page, but not a lot of violence. And it's something, you know, you can give your grandmother to read. So I think the setting for any book though helps set mood and theme, and, you know, it's kind of part of the story promise. Whether it's a cozy or not. And I'm now writing a young adult suspense, and I feel like it's even more important to the mood of it to have a very detailed and rich setting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, setting, it's not just a place, it's the environment in which your characters operate. So it really affects every part of your story.
Right.
And I think that one of the reasons people love to read in general and love to read crime fiction specifically is that they are set in places that the reader herself may have never visited or had visited and wanted to see rendered in fiction. I think it's a big draw with our genre in particular.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm curious too about, you know, each of you in terms of genre. You know, there's so many subgenres in crime fiction. Like Kathy, why cozies? Lisa, why thrillers? You know, what draws you to specific genres? And when you want to jump genre and write another, what is that? You know, I mean, I think I've always written, I don't have as much experience as both of you in writing crime fiction, but I tend toward noir. That tends to be where I go. I don't know, maybe I'm jaded, more jaded than the two of you, but but how do you pick, how'd you pick the genres you write in?
So for me, I started writing because I fell in love with the Stephanie Plum series, Genevieve Vanovich, and I wanted to have that kind of, you know, crazy character, but in suburbia, you know, California, where I lived. And so my first book I wrote was actually called PTA Meetings Are Murder. And it was, you know, about the death of the PTA president in, you know, in San Diego suburbia. And I was a PTA president, so it was kind of one of those, you know, write what you know things. And it, that book, I edited it 100 zillion times, and it got me my agent, but she wanted me to write a new series, and that's how the Cozies, and she's the one who told me, oh, you have a cozy voice. Humorous mysteries, you know, Cozies are usually humorous mysteries. So then I started, you know, learning about more about the cozy part of crime fiction. And then switching genres, I have a critique group, Barry Summy, that writes middle grade. I have my daughter writes young adult short stories, Sheena Krivat. And so I do read a lot of YA, and I've kind of thought that's what would be my next step. So
interesting. What about you, Lisa?
Well, I'm not really that intentional. You know, I didn't. So I'd written a lot. I've written since I was quite, you know, since I realized there were words that you could put into sentences and tell stories. So I was one of those. When I started Rock, Paper, Tiger, which was my first published book, it was the first book that I started with the intention of, I am writing something that I'm going to sell. I always just sort of wrote what I felt like. And I thought, you know, what do I have to bring to the table, you know, that would be different? And what I had was experience in China, in contemporary China. And there were not, as far as I could tell, very many books written by Western authors with this perspective. You know, the China books that I read written by Americans tended to be period pieces. I would call them, you know, foot binding and tragedy, you know, basically. And I was like, well, there's this whole other side of China now that is really interesting, and people don't know it, and it'd be fun to write. And then I was really pissed off about the war on terror in the Iraq war. It was that anger lasted a long time. And I was like, well, how could I put these two things together? And I came up with this character to do that. But, you know, it still turned out to be a pretty odd book. And I got all kinds of contradictory messages when I queried it. You know, like one person would really love the main character, but not the secondary character. Somebody else would really love the secondary characters, but not the main character. I have one agent recommend that I rewrite it as women's fiction. My favorite was that they loved the setting, but ultimately felt that it was a bit too foreign. That was, you know, and what are you supposed to do with that information? So anyway, I finally hooked up with an agent, that, you know, Nathan Bransford, who we just really were on the same page, as it were. And he recommended carving away some of the story and pointing it more firmly towards suspense, which was what I felt that needed to be done as well. So, you know, I write these books and they're all kind of different. I mean, my second book, Getaway, was my idea of a noir thriller, speaking of noir, which was, you know, a man or a woman meets who is in trouble meets a man or a woman who is trouble, and things go from bad to very bad to much worse. And so that was what I did for that one. And then, you know, when Rock, Paper, Tiger sold, I went back and did a couple more Ellie books. And the second one was kind of I called it a lighthearted romp through the environmental apocalypse. So, you know, it's a road, you know, sort of a road story and a she's trying to find somebody story. And the third one really is the closest thing to a mystery where there is a murder and there are suspects and she needs to solve it or get pinned for it, basically. And then, you know, Go Between was back more firmly in suspense and sort of a cat and mouse game between the protagonist and this really awful villain who I just love to write. And then Black Swan Rising, I started in the middle of 2014 and it was about misogyny, online harassment, and mass shootings in the context of a highly polarized political campaign. Yay. And I went back to that one. You know, I had written the first chapter and the outline for a pitch and put it aside to finish Go Between. And then I went back and finished Black Swan Rising. I wrote the bulk of it in 2016. And yeah, that was a pretty surreal experience. So I just kind of write, you know, they fall in this kind of suspense more than classical mystery. I think because suspense is a really good genre to deal with global issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since I don't want to write essays and I don't want to be didactic, I really enjoy engaging with material like that in fiction and on the level of story and character. So it works for me, but, you know, who knows what is going to be next? I'm not really sure yet.
Does your agent wish you would just stick with like one genre, one subgenre?
Well, see, the thing is, my first two books, they were, my first five books were with Soho Press, Soho Crime. And the first two of them were published under their general literature line. And then they switched me over to the crime line. So my stuff has always been kind of in that boundary, border, whatever you want to call it, liminal place. And so, you know, there's a continuity between them all. And my agent, I don't think she's ever felt I've done anything that was way outside of that basic idea. And she's like, you know, Catherine Fawcett with Curtis Brown, just an absolutely marvelous person to work with on every level. And actually, if your listeners follow crime fiction, they may know that Midnight Inc., which was a huge publisher of crime fiction, shuttered its doors, and Black Swan Rising was published by them. So mm-hmm. we got the rights back and just republished. We have the ebook out that I did that in partnership with my agency. So yeah, they've been extremely supportive.
That's great. Was it hard getting rights back?
You know, not really. I mean, it took a while because they wanted to sell as many as they could. But at the end of the day, you know, when a parent publisher decides they're shuttering an imprint, they just don't want to hassle with it anymore. And I think that they kept a few, some titles that are still, you know, a series that have sold well for them, but they've reverted the rights to almost everybody as far as I know. And if you ask, they'll give them to you. Cause you know, they just, you know, they're still there. They're in their catalog, but there's not going to be any kind of promotion or marketing or you know, institutional support. So mm-hmm. yeah, they were pretty good about returning rights.
Are both of you plotters or pantsers?
I am a plotter who I do a pretty detailed outline and then I forget it as I write. So, mm-hmm. but I do know who the villain is. I've learned that lesson that I have to know a lot about the villain.
Yeah, so you know what you're writing. Do you know what you're writing toward? Do you know what ending you're writing toward?
I can write almost everything until even after six books, I can't figure out that last plot twist until I actually write it. Even though I know where I'm going, I can't figure. I don't know how to get that figured out until I'm actually writing it.
What about you, Lisa?
I am a pantser, which I'm sure will come as no surprise. I do generally have some signposts that I'm writing toward, and there are points in the story that I know that need to happen. You know, kind of big, you know, usually it's like, oh, the point of biggest trauma, you know, that I know. But since I'm not generally writing puzzle mysteries, mm-hmm. It's not such an issue for me. I mean, like I said, I think the closest thing to that was Dragon Day, and it still allowed me. And I knew, you know, like I knew a couple of settings for that. I knew that I had to go. I'd gone to this big Chinese film studio that has like a recreation of the Forbidden City and all of this, and I visited it because I thought that had to be interesting. And then of course it was like, okay, so this has to be in the book somehow. So put that as a signpost. So yeah, that's what I do.
I also don't write linearly pretty often. If I get stuck, I just jump ahead to a scene that I know will be included, or sometimes they don't always stay in, but I write kind of the fun scenes to get myself out of being blocked.
See, I write straight through and I write, my first drafts are pretty slow, but the advantage is my first drafts are usually pretty, I mean, they take me a long time, but then I don't have as much rewriting to do because I've been so damn slow getting through the first draft.
Mm. I think, you know, I've been working on a novel for 7 years. I don't know. It's been a long time. And I think if there is ever a next time, I think I want to write it really fast before I change, you know, because it's like every year I'm somebody different almost, or I'm, you know, my reading interests are vary. And then I'm like, well, I got to get rid of this subplot and I got to do this and I have to do that. And I don't know. It's really,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's become a mess. I think the next time I don't want one point of view character. I want, you know, multiple point of view characters. So, you know, they fill up the book in a different way. I don't know. I just may be a short story writer for all I know. I mean, it just, I don't know what my problem is.
Short stories are tricky. I really, you know, I haven't written that many of them, and it's kind of like I don't necessarily have a lot of confidence that I'm going to be able to do it. You know, it's just a very different, it's a very different format.
It is, but it's, you know, you're gratified a lot sooner, right? I mean, it's just like,
that's true.
You know, it's true. Maybe a couple of months instead of like, for me, it's going on 8 years now that I'm with this one book. And so when I break away from it and write short stories or essays, I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, okay. That's why I like this.
I should say that by slow, I mean, my first drafts take me about a year and a half or so, you know, year and a half, 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I've definitely had things when I was first writing longer form stuff that dragged on over a number of years because, you know, you're teaching yourself how to do it for one thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, and even though, you know, like every book is different. It's like that kind of Zen parable that, you know, you don't want to use the boat to cross the river, but you don't want to carry it on your back up the mountain. So it's not that everything necessary, you know, it doesn't carry over from book to book, but you do learn things, you know, from each experience. And some of that does transfer. At least that's how I experience it.
So how long will you both let a book sit? I mean, will you let it chill before you go into revision, or do you just, you know, you're at the end, you start over again? What will you do? Do you have readers? I know Kathy mentioned a critique group. You know, do you run stuff by readers all the time, or do you wait, or do you just give it to your agent?
I don't have that a real critique group right now. I've definitely had people read things before I've turned it over to my agent, but other times I've just turned partials over to my agent just to get a sense of, you know, especially when we've been working on, you know, trying to pitch things from a partial and a proposal. But, you know, when you're being published and you're writing a book that's under contract, you know, or you're aiming that way, there's not generally a lot of time between the finishing the draft and having to deal with revisions. So, you know, it's nice if you have like a week or two off from it to disengage your brain a little bit. But it's not like it's generally going to be a long period of time if it's something that you're writing for, you know, a particular purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very motivated by the deadline. So I am writing and editing right up until the deadline. So there's not a lot of opportunity. This is once I had publishing contracts. There's not a lot of time to get anybody else involved. I do have my critique group read quite a bit of it. And then my husband is very good at finding plot holes. So But other than that, I don't take a lot of time off before I submit it.
Mm. Wow. Anyway, so much to think about and so much more I would love to talk about. But I want to, you know, before I forget, I wanted to go back to Crossing Borders. And I wanted to ask you, Lisa, about arranging the collection. How you did that? I mean, how did you look for, you know, themes and stories running one to the next? Did you, you know, want to do just the opposite if one story was set you know, in a certain place, have the next one be totally different? I mean, how'd you put them together?
I don't remember. I think Matt and I just sort of came up with a list and went, well, is this okay? Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, let's just switch this one. You know, it was pretty intuitive. And I'd have to look to see what the order is even now. Sorry, I don't have more insight into that. I've completely forgotten how we did it.
What about... Oh, go ahead, Kathy.
I wasn't involved with any of that, but after reading the stories, I just think it's kind of amazing how different they can be. There's some that are, you know, are police investigations, but there's, you know, they're set in Colombia and Berlin and Mexico and in the future and in the past. And I thought there's just so many talented writers in the book. And some, you know, this is the first time they've been published, so that was, you know, very fun part of it. I don't know, every story had something unique, and it just, sometimes they were so suspenseful, it was hard to keep reading them. You know, like, it's kind of interesting that you can pack so much into a short story.
And you were the one dealing with the publisher, is that correct?
Well, no, that was Kim Keyline. So she's the current president of Partners in Crime, which is the San Diego chapter of Sisters in Crime. I was just there a little bit at the beginning.
I see. Okay. What about the cover? How did the cover come about?
Oh, Kim designed that too.
She did a mock-up of it, and then we ended up doing something more photorealistic, I think, based on her design. So it was a collaboration between, you know, primarily between Kim and Down and Out, and then, you know, Matt and I threw in our two cents.
I really like it. I think it's just a beautiful cover.
Yeah, it came out great. It really did.
And then the foreword by Rachel Housel Hall. It's a nice little foreword.
Yeah, well, we wanted to have one of our guests of honor write it. And Rachel very generously agreed to do it. And Jeff Parker blurbed it for us also. You know, I mean, it's always going to be the conference that never was, and you know, they were great. Rachel and Jeff just were so generous with their time and their efforts, and I'm just sorry that more people didn't get a chance to, you know, honor them the way that they deserve to be honored.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, about the conference, because, you know, I remember, you know, I was going to ride down with Greta Boris, who also has a story in Crossing Borders. And so we were going to room together, and we were planning to drive down together. And right up to the last minute, we kept going back and forth going, you know, are we going? Are we not going? And she's like, I think we should go. And I'm like, I think we should go too. But in the meantime, people are pulling out. And so, you know, I mean, did you worry at any point that it was going to be totally canceled, or did you have to at least make you cancel so you wouldn't lose all that money? I mean, because it was really, you know, because the city came down and said, or I don't know if it was Newsom or the city that said, you know, you got to close because you have more than, 250 people?
250, yeah.
The county that shut us down.
The county, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and the state, you know, we could see which way it was going. But, you know, so Tammy Kaler, who's another wonderful author who used to be in Long Beach and is now in San Diego County, she and I were doing the programming. And we had an extremely ambitious programming slate because this was on track to be one of the largest, if not the largest, left coast crime ever. Mm-hmm. So as people started dropping out, it was just this constant struggle to fill these slots, juggle, you know, we canceled a few things, you know, other authors who were participating generously agreed to step in to fill some of the holes. I was very concerned the whole time. I mean, I was just like going, you know, one of my little jobs is following the news, and I could kind of see which way this was headed. And I'm just glad, you know, I'm glad no one got sick for the time that we were meeting. I'm super sad that it worked out the way that it did. But, you know, there was obviously there was no other choice. And if the cancellation had happened sooner or later, you know, but it was just so bizarre that we got to, you know, half of the first day.
Right.
You know, it was strange. And I mean, I just remember standing there, you know, wandering around, basically troubleshooting and explaining to people what was going on. And you just felt like there's this tsunami coming in slow motion, and I could see it coming. And I would just look at all of the people gathered and going like, oh, it was a uniquely stressful experience. I'll just put it that way.
Well, I remember we Greta and I were back from dinner and saw you somewhere outside on a patio or something. And when you said that you were getting shut down, I think at first I thought you were kidding. I'm
yeah.
like, oh yeah, that's a good one. You're like,
yeah.
No, we have to go home. Like, oh
yeah,
okay. You know, that was a good trip. Yeah, wild. You know, we should say a little bit about Sisters in Crime, actually, because a lot of the people listening may not know what Sisters in Crime is, right?
Entirely possible.
Yeah. And I don't know how many chapters there are around the country, but, you know, I've been involved with the one in Orange County for a few years. I'm president this year, which is all my online presidency. It's kind of funny, but you know, all of our events have come online. But you know, for those of you out there who are interested in any sort of crime fiction, you know, Sisters in Crime is an organization that supports female crime writers, and it's an organization made up of readers and writers, and we have quite a few men who belong, the Misters. They are, quite a few. I don't know what the oldest chapter is. Would it be one back east?
Well, Sarah Paretsky was the founder, so I'm guessing one of the founders anyway, you know, and she's based in Chicago, correct?
I think so.
Maybe?
So.
Yeah. You know, Sisters in Crime, I mean, you know, there's a lot of great organizations. MWA also does a lot of really positive things. But, you know, Sisters in Crime, I think, is in particular known for its mentorship and programs for authors, writers who are aspiring to be published. And it's a great organization, and I highly recommend it.
There have been a lot of great webinars, too, that are archived on the website. And the dues are pretty minimal, I think, pretty affordable. Maybe $50 for national, $25 or $40 for your chapter, something like that, a year.
Yeah.
And it's pretty affordable.
The fact that now that everything's on Zoom, at our last meeting, we had people Zooming in from all over the country. So that's just one advantage to doing the workshops online. When we have normal meetings, we get anywhere from 20 to 50 people. And so it was actually pretty good to have so many people watching our last Zoom meeting.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, because, you know, at first I think everyone's going, what are we gonna do? We can't have meetings anymore. And now, yeah, I mean, all the events I've been involved with, there's so many more people, and I, you know, even local people who were, I don't know if they don't want to drive or if they just want to stay home. It's a Sunday when our meeting is, or what the problem is, but it's just been great to see so many people coming out and getting involved. It'll be curious what will happen when we're allowed to meet again, right? What we'll all do with Zoom and literary events. I don't know. It'll be interesting. So I imagine we're coming to the end of our time. I always like to end these talks with advice for the writers listening. Do either of you or both of you have any tips or advice for perhaps the crime writers listening, battling their way through a novel or a short story?
I love to talk about this one thing that I learned at a workshop, that someone pointed out that writing is like a golf swing. And this is more for beginning readers, I guess. So everybody, and I fell into the same category. I thought I used to be in public relations and marketing, so I totally assumed I could write a novel. And then I floundered around for months until I figured out a little bit about what I didn't know. And so everybody thinks writing is simple, right? And everybody thinks a golf swing is very simple. You just, you know, aim at the ball, but there's actually 70 things to learn during a golf swing.
It's wow. Kind of
like writing, there's so many things that you have to learn, and some of it you're going to have an innate talent for, but mostly you're going to have a lot to learn. So many people give up when the first book they write or the first thing they write isn't perfect, it isn't what they actually visualize in their head. And it's just like any type of art form. It's nobody thinks they're going to be an amazing sculptor or, you know, fine artist without training. But a lot of people do think that they can write a novel without training. Mm-hmm. And everything about writing is learnable, you know, with craft books or workshops or classes. So that's the one thing I tell people, is just to keep writing and keep learning.
Yeah, good one. Yeah, I mean, you know, musicians, my husband's a musician and I watch him every day, and he's a working musician. He works, you know, at least he was before everything closed down, but, you know, he'd have
you
know, 4 or 5 gigs a week, and he's still in the studio practicing, you know.
What does he play?
He plays guitar. He plays blues and jazz mostly.
I play in bands, and my former bandmates up in Los Angeles, you know, they're also professional musicians, and of course this is hitting them all pretty hard.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it sure is. I know. Anyway, but every day he's practicing like he has a gig coming up, you know. It's just like,
yeah,
and eventually he probably will. But, you know, writers, we forget about the practicing part, especially when you're starting out. You just think it should all be a lot easier, or you hope it is.
Right. Well, I completely agree with everything that you say and what Kathy said. And I'd also add that, you know, writing a novel is a lot like eating an elephant. It's a really big job, and you just have to sort of, you know, take it a bite at a time and not think about the totality of the project sometimes, because it's overwhelming when you think about how much work it is and how many hours it's going to be. So I like to tell people, like, focus on your next sentence, you know, make that sentence really good. And then your next sentence, make that sentence really good. And, you know, try to deal with it in digestible pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I like to tell people to, you don't know what you don't know until you start, until you get into not just the writing, but also the publishing business, and that going to conferences kind of helps you to learn what you still need to learn. I volunteer with a writing conference for high school kids. It's a free writing conference here in San Diego, going into its 10th year next year. And that's kind of, you know, what we try to do is expose these young writers to not just craft, but also a little bit of what you need to do to get published or what you need to do to find a writing job.
Oh, that's so great. You know, I mean, I know I could have used that when I was in college, even, you know, where I went back east, a little college in Vermont, you know, nobody ever talked about the business of writing or, you know, how to navigate it. You know, it was all about, I mean, I appreciate what I did get, which was all about the art and the craft, but, you know, nothing, you know, I get out of school going, Oh, I wonder if there's any jobs for short story writers in the paper. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No,
I mentioned that it's called the CCA Writers Conference, so people can go to that website to check it out, because any high school student can attend as long as they're within, driving distance or travel distance. And this year, of course, it had to go online. It was scheduled for March. So,
did you say CCA?
Yes, CCA. CCA. Okay, Writers Conference. Yeah.
You know, about writers' conferences, I think, what's coming up next? BoucherCon in October?
No, it's canceled.
It's canceled? I thought it was going to be online. It's not even going to be online.
Oh, no. I don't know about that. I just know that the physical conference was canceled.
Yeah.
I don't know what the online plans are.
And then for Left Coast Crime next spring, is that up in the air, whether it's going to happen?
Well, it's in Albuquerque, I don't know how they could I don't think they can make the decision at this point.
Yeah,
right. Oy. Anyway, well, we have Zoom.
Yes,
we have lots. Yeah. There's lots of virtual events every day anymore. So. Fortunately, imagine this happening and we have no internet, had no way to connect. That kind of be a drag, but anyway.
Yeah, at least there
I appreciate
is
you both taking the time to do this. I hope we get the word out a bit about crossing borders and have people picking it up, taking a look.
If you go to the website, sistersincrimesd.org, you can buy directly from Partners in Crime all the books that we had purchased for the launch party at Left Coast. But also, and then anywhere books are sold, it's also available.
Well, thank you so much for having us, Barbara.
My computer is, I think, freaking out. I don't know if you can hear me.
Oh, now we can.
Okay, good. I don't know what happened, but the last thing I heard was launch party.
Oh, yeah, just that we have a lot of books available that you can buy directly from us, or you can buy it anywhere books are sold. So, and I also want to say thanks for having us.
Good. Yeah. And I think I bought one from one of my students. I collect fines from them. If they make their goals at the beginning of the session. And then by the end, if they didn't, accomplish what they hoped, they pay whatever they wagered. And so, yeah, I'm handing it out. Anyway, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. It's great talking to you.
Great to talk.